a captain in the United States Marine Corps who saw combat in the Pacific, an economist at MIT and the University of Chicago, in the Nixon administration, Secretary of Labor, Director of the Office of Management and the Budget, and Secretary of the Treasury, then President of the Bechtel Group, and then, during the Reagan administration, Secretary of State, now a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. On Uncommon Knowledge today, a conversation with one of the most genuinely accomplished men in American life, George Shultz. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. With us today, former Secretary of State George Shultz, who just last month turned 95. Happy birthday. Mulling over our conversation, it came to me that the last time we spoke, you mentioned you were about to spend the holidays with grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I have kids. I framed some questions from their point of view. Based on your long and magnificent life, what would you say to the rising generation about what they need to know? The Cold War. Let's begin with the Cold War. The conflict begins right after the Second World War, just as you're starting out in professional life. You've graduated from Princeton. You've served in the Marine Corps. Did you have your, when did you get your doctorate in economics? Was that
1949?
Okay, so you graduate, you get a doctorate at MIT as the Cold War is getting into full swing. More than four decades, two powerful nations, heavily armed, and at the end of it all, it comes to a peaceful end, and our side wins. What did the United States get right during those 45 years that bears on the present day?
First of all, we got right our analysis by George F. Kennan to begin with. He studied the Soviet Union. He had been there a lot. And he wrote what was called the Long Telegram from Moscow.
1947, as I recall.
Something like that. And basically what he said was, this is a bad regime, and if we can contain it for long enough, it will look inside and what it sees will not like, and it will change. So the doctrine of containment emerged out of that. Contain them for a long time and change will come. Now,
yes,
we deviated from that, and the concept of detente emerged with the concept of linkage. Detente said, we're here, they're there, that's life. The name of the game is peaceful coexistence. And they also thought that everything was linked. So if something bad happens over here, you stop over there, and so on. So those two doctrines were in place when Ronald Reagan took office. And he deviated from them. He went back to the Kennan formulation. He said, sooner or later, this terrible outfit will change. And
that's important. So that's important to grasp that Ronald Reagan, when he first came into office, the historical record, I'd like to get to the way history views him, but when he first came into office, large elements of the press and what might be called the establishment were at a minimum very uneasy. He seemed to be doing something new. He wasn't doing anything new. He was going back to the policy of containment that had been set in place by Harry Truman and pursued by Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, John Kennedy, a Democrat. He was going back to a previous bipartisan successful policy. Is that correct?
That's analytically correct, although I don't think he thought of it that way.
Oh, really?
He just looked at the situation himself, and he drew whatever from the past, but his view was fresh.
All right.
He gave a speech in June 1982 to the British Parliament, called the Westminster Speech. And he laid out all of his views. It's a wonderful speech.
In 82.
He said that the communism will be on the
ash heap of history. And Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the historian, said that anybody who thought the Soviet Union was near collapse was just kidding himself. Do you remember that? The press, all right. Which raises this, another question. Today we hear a substantial body of opinion says, oh, no, Ronald Reagan, George Shultz, they had nothing to do with the end of the Cold War. the USSR was so rotten, so corrupt, so economically weak and backward that it was due to fall in on itself anyway, and it would have done so right on schedule no matter what the United States did. Do you buy any of that?
Well, I think it was a corrupt system. And interestingly, Gorbachev came along. He's the first leader who ever lived in the Soviet Union.
Who grew up under the
system. He grew up in it. He saw what it was really like. His predecessors lived in cocoons. Their wives shopped in special stores. They didn't really know what life was like. But at any rate, yes, I think that probably it was a doomed system. On the other hand, it helped a lot to have strong military capability. I might say strength is not the same thing as force. We didn't use force much, but we had lots of strength. Here's an example. The Soviets had deployed what were called SS-20 missiles. They were intermediate range missiles aimed at Europe. And the idea was to separate us from Europe, to say if they attacked Europe with those, not attacking us, would we risk retaliation from them by defending Europe with our intercontinental missiles? So we had an agreement in NATO that we would have a negotiation with the Soviets to try to get an agreement on intermediate range missiles. And if we couldn't get those negotiations done properly, there would be NATO deployments in Britain, Italy, and Germany. In Germany, they would be ballistic missiles called Pershings, nuclear tipped.
Right.
So the negotiations go on. Our position was zero on each side. There were 1,500 Soviets deployed, none on our side. People said, are you crazy? There's no chance to get that bargain. Anyway, that
was... We were asking them to destroy a huge investment in return for our not spending the first dollar.
Exactly. So that was the negotiation, and it didn't work out. So we deployed our missiles.
We did it.
And that was accompanied by a lot of war talk from the Soviets. And they walked out of the negotiations. It was a very tense period. But Ronald Reagan's backbone was stiff, and our allies, the cohesion of the alliance was there on display. That was strength. So at the end of the year, that was 1983, I might say we had, in response to the Soviets shooting down a Korean airliner, we led the charge in condemning them, but we also sent our negotiators back to Geneva, breaking with the concept of linkage.
I see.
And that was so important because the battle was to convince our allies to go ahead with the deployments. That was the propaganda or diplomatic battle, and we succeeded. So then President Reagan, we had a coordinated approach. President Reagan gave a sort of broad, general, reasonably conciliatory speech. And I had a meeting, a big international meeting, at which Gromyko was present, where I gave a more operational version. Then I had a private meeting with Gromyko, which was tense, but workable, doable. And then as time went on, things gradually softened. We stood firm, they softened. And by August of that year, I went to the president and said, Mr. President, in four capitals of Europe, a Soviet diplomat went up to one of ours at a cocktail party and said virtually the same thing, which was, if invited to Washington when he comes to the General Assembly, Gromyko will accept. In other words, the Soviets blinked.
They were willing to talk.
And I said to him, you may want to think this over, Mr. President, because Jimmy Carter canceled those meetings when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and they're still there. He said, I don't have to think it over. Let's get them here. So we got them there, and it was a giant event. It was a turning point. And there was one little thing that was sort of fun. Nancy Reagan was my pal.
She still
is. So
this
was coming up. And I said to her, Nancy, the routine is, he comes to the West Wing, we have a meeting in the Oval Office, we walk down the colonnade to the mansion, there we have a little stand around time, and then there's a working lunch. The mansion is your home, you're the hostess. how about being there for the stand-around time and greet people? And she liked the idea, so she's there. Gromyko is a smart guy, has been around. As soon as he sees Nancy Reagan, he makes a beeline for her like there's nobody else in the room. And at one point, he says to her, "Does your husband want peace?" And Nancy can bristle. She says, "Of course my husband wants peace." And then Gromyko says, "Well then, every night before he goes to sleep, whisper in his ear, peace." And he was a little taller than she was, so she put her hands on his shoulder and pushed him down so he had to bend his knees a little bit. She said, "I'll whisper it in your ear, peace." But after
George, what was
that,
I'm
and
sorry.
After the election, we restarted the arms control negotiations. I met with Gromyko in Geneva, and things started to move. This is all before Gorbachev, I might say.
Yes, before we get to Gorbachev, Gromyko, you mentioned you had a meeting with Gromyko, the two of you, at the tensest moment. What was he like? We'll come to Gorbachev in a moment, but Gromyko was the embodiment of the old order. He'd come up under Stalin. He'd seen everything. What was it like to deal with one of the old line communists?
Well, he had a clear set view. He's a smart guy. Don't underestimate his mental capacities. But he had a very standardized view, and he was predictable. We wanted him to pay attention to, for instance, to some problems of Soviet Jewry, and I would give him lists. And people said
lists of refuseniks that you wanted, right?
That he should do something about. And everybody told me he wouldn't do it. But I managed to get him to do it. And then on one occasion, I got permission. Everything was tense in those days. To say to him, "Look, why don't we work on a couple of things together?" He said, "Well, what should we work on?" "Well, how about nuclear non-proliferation in Southern Africa?" So he came back and he said, "Okay, we'll work on nuclear non-proliferation." They didn't want nuclear proliferation any more than we did. So we did some constructive things on that. So you could work with him, but he was difficult. He was smart.
But you respected him in a certain sense.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, all right. Gorbachev, what was it like to meet Gorbachev for the first time?
The first time I met Gorbachev was at the funeral of his predecessor, Chernenko. And our delegation met with him in the Kremlin. I think we were one of the last to meet with him.
This would have been 86, if I recall correctly.
85. So he had to organize this big funeral. He was the general secretary. And he met with endless numbers of delegations that are there from elsewhere. And we're one of the last. Vice President Bush was with us, so he was the head of our delegation. I had a couple of things the president wanted me to say, but mostly I could have the luxury of being able to sit back and watch. And what I saw was a guy who had a lot of notes in front of him, shuffled them around, he never looked at them. And he was much more conversant with all sorts of issues than any of his predecessors had been.
More so than Gromyko?
Yes, I think more so than Gromyko, at least a more flexible working mind. And I had a baseline because I had met with Soviet leaders going back to when I was Secretary of the Treasury, and I had done deals and worked with them. So I had a base of comparison more than anybody else did there. And after we got back to our embassy, I said to our guides, I said, "This is the most formidable Soviet leader we've ever dealt with. He's smart, he's quick, he can shift gears. We'll have to be on our alert to keep up with him. But there's one thing that's really different. You can have a conversation with him. Before, you say something, it goes by my ear. I say something, it goes by your ear. That's not a conversation. Right. He says something, he expects you to engage with what he said. And he'll listen to what you say and engage with what you said. So that's different." Anyway, I was impressed.
So you knew right away this was something different?
This was something different.
George, this question of character. Ronald Reagan, I want to return to President Reagan for a moment. Clark Clifford, former Secretary of Defense, a principal aide to Harry Truman. Ronald Reagan arrives in town in January 1981, and former Secretary of Defense Clark Clifford refers to him as, quote, an amiable dunce. likable but nothing upstairs. And that was the view of much of Washington, and frankly, it's the view of many people even today. On the other hand, this so-called amiable dunce cuts taxes, rebuilds our defenses. That's a lot to get through Congress, and he got it through. And beginning in 1983, the economy begins to grow. There's a 25 years of economic growth that begins with the Reagan economic program and starts in 1983. And by the time you and he leave office, the Cold War is all over but the shouting, so to speak. I don't mean to diminish what George Bush and Jim Baker did in helping Germany reunite and so forth, but fundamentally the Soviet Union was done by the time Ronald Reagan and you left office. How did this amiable dunce do all that?
Well, he, like President Eisenhower, enjoyed being underestimated. He feels, if people underestimate me, they won't be on guard and I'll just go right by them without even looking. So that's basically what he did. He was happy to be underestimated, didn't bother. But in the early days, I was chaired his economic advisory committees all through the primary and the campaign.
Before becoming Secretary of State, you were working on economics. Yes.
And when we took office, inflation was in the teens. The economy was in the doldrums. I knew, he knew, we all knew, you couldn't have a decent economy unless you got inflation under control. And there was Paul Volcker over at the Fed. Paul had been my undersecretary when I was Secretary of the Treasury. I knew him well. And Paul was doing what needed to be done, namely discipline the money supply. And people kept running into the Oval Office, Mr. President, he's going to cause a recession. We're going to lose seats in the midterm election. And what did Reagan do? He put a political umbrella over Paul Volcker because he knew that Paul was doing something that needed to be done. We did have a recession. We did lose seats. But by the time 1983 arrived, inflation was under control and everybody could see it was going to stay that way. And the tax cut incentives that he had put into effect took off and the economy took off like a bird. But I always thought this was Ronald Reagan's finest hour in domestic policy. In being a person who could take a short-term hit in order to have a long-term good result for the economy and for the American people.
I once had a conversation about that with your friend, the late Milton Friedman. He said exactly the same thing, that to him what was most impressive about Ronald Reagan was what he didn't do, didn't lean on Paul Volcker, took the hit. So was Reagan clearly, to Clark Clifford, to the amiable dunce school, they're misreading him profoundly.
He was happy enough to have them relax like that.
So what are they, was he more wide, he knew more than they thought he knew? He was more intelligent than they thought? I'm glad we're doing this because I've often meant to ask you and now I'm going to ask you whether people tended to think of him, deride him because he was an actor and they would miss the 6 years he spent as president of the Screen Actors Guild. He was a union boss. He knew how to negotiate. Was that an important part of?
Of course, he loved negotiation. And I had twice a week private meetings with him. And sometimes what we do, we just talk about negotiation. He'd tell me about some of his Screen Actors Guild negotiations and I'd tell him about some of my experiences. So I got to know how he went about things and how to get something accomplished. See, government is not just about ideas. You have to translate the ideas into making something happen, execution. And between his Screen Actors Guild experience, as experience, remember, 8 years as governor of California.
Yes.
It's a pretty significant state.
He'd done a lot.
He had experience. It was not. And also it's true that if you are an actor, what is the skill? It's a skill of figuring out how you put something across, how you put a character across, how you put an idea across. That's the skill. So those skills are useful to a president because you're trying to convince people of something important that's sometimes controversial and difficult, but you've got to convince them it's the thing to do.
George, I want to ask you, I'm going to indulge myself here because I just I just want to ask these questions. I'm going to stay with the Cold War a little bit longer before turning to the United States today. You've talked about the deployment of the Pershing missiles in 1983 as a turning point in the Cold War because it showed we'd do it. We'd do what we said we were going to do, and we could hold the NATO coalition together. What is the importance, roughly 3.5 years later, of the summit meeting in Reykjavik?
Well, that was a meeting where Gorbachev, the Soviet Union, proposed all of our positions in negotiations. And one time he was going to say something, I put his hand on it, I said, let him talk. He was just conceding. So all the first morning was the Soviets put on the line all the things that we were bargaining for in Geneva. But then they made everything dependent on us, in effect, giving up Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, which he wouldn't do, and I agreed with him.
You did agree with him?
Oh, yes, right. Absolutely.
Right. And so...
In fact, during the meeting, when they put all this juicy stuff on the table, he sent me a note, and he would not give up on SDI, and he wrote a little note to me, George, am I right? And I wrote, absolutely.
Why was he right? If they were giving us, if they were going to eliminate whole classes of nuclear weapons, they were conceding everything, and all the scientists, the Union for Concerned Scientists, if I remember the name, it's still in existence, if that's the group, if I'm remembering it correctly, their analysis was the Strategic Defense Initiative would never work, this idea of a Star Wars shield over the country, it was all a lot of cockamamie scientific nonsense. Why was he unwilling to, and why did you advise him to refuse to surrender something that was completely speculative in return for something real and substantive? Why was that your position?
Your question shows your naivete.
Go right ahead and slap me around.
Well, why did they put all this on the table? Because of SDI.
You had them on the run.
We take away SDI, what's going to happen? They're not going to carry through. You've got to keep your power there if we're going to carry through. Strength, but verify. But President Reagan didn't have the idea that somehow we're going to put a big shield over everything. He understood the nature of strategic defense. And at the end of the Reykjavik meeting, we'd also talked about getting rid of ballistic missiles as well as nuclear weapons. Gorbachev said to him, Mr. President, if we abolish ballistic missiles, why do you need a defense against them? And President Reagan said, because people now know how to make them. And there will always be some rogue state that comes along that'll have a few. And you and I will then be glad we know how to defend ourselves against them. And we'll even share our technology with you. And Gorbachev says, Mr. President, you won't even share milk technology with us. But anyway, what it showed was his concept was you can defend yourself against a few missiles. And we have learned a lot, and actually I think by now we can probably do that. Mm-hmm. And the Israelis with their dome, they're pretty happy that research went on in this regard.
All right. The country today. We've just been talking about the Cold War, peace through strength, skillful diplomacy, engagement with the rest of the world. And after 45 years of containment, the Soviet Union does collapse. Bipartisan, extended effort. What do you make of American foreign policy today?
Well, I think we have the same principles that we need to put into operation. That is, peace through strength. We need to be a lot stronger than we are getting ourselves into the position of being. And then we need to engage and exercise on that basis. Here's Russia basically destroying boundaries. The state system of governance is based on respect for boundaries. Russia is destroying boundaries and destroying agreements. They made an agreement when Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. Britain, U.S., and Russia agreed to respect the boundaries of Ukraine. So Russia's doing that. They're now in the Middle East for the first time in a long while. So that's going on. Then we have ISIS, which says they don't believe in countries and is engaged in a terrorist campaign that threatens us, without a doubt. I might say, parenthetically, that there's a new book about Thomas Jefferson out. And in it, it relates an occasion where John Adams, who was our ambassador to London, he was subsequently president, and Thomas Jefferson, who was our ambassador in Paris, Adams invites Jefferson to come to London because he says there's a new ambassador from Tripoli. Maybe we can talk him out of all the things they were doing. They were capturing ships and enslaving sailors. And
piracy in the Mediterranean.
The Barbary pirates.
Right.
And they concluded that negotiation was fruitless. And they asked him why they did these things, and he said it's written in the Quran and so on. It's right out of the ISIS playbook. This is 200 years ago, actually. And we were paying them off. And by the time Jefferson became president, he had had it. And he beefed up our Navy, and he went there and basically militarily destroyed them. So that put that to rest. We could learn something from Jefferson.
All right. We've discussed the character of President Reagan. For that matter, we've talked about the character of Gorbachev. Here we are in a presidential election season. Without naming specific candidates, I'll try to get you to do that in a moment, but for now, without naming specific candidates, what are the qualities, what kind of character would you advise grandchildren of yours who may be voting age for the first time to look for in a candidate? What's relevant to that job, to the presidency?
You want somebody who has common sense. You want somebody who has experience. If you can know a lot. Here's a little story about something that happened to me at MIT. A guy named Bemis is made a faculty member. And he gets up in a meeting and he says, I'm honored to be a member of this great faculty. It shows what my colleagues in the administration think of me. But maybe it would be interesting a couple of the old-timers down Maine where I grew up think. So there's a couple are listening to the radio and the announcement comes through. Bemis made a professor at MIT. And one says, I'm not surprised right from the first grade. He was a smart kid. It was, that's right. He said, everything that went in one ear didn't come out the other. So he got to know more and more all the time. The other one says, that's right. By this time, he probably knows everything. The other one says, that's right. That Bemis may know everything, but he don't realize nothing. So what you realize is what you get from your experience. And to a very considerable extent, it guides you. Not that what you know isn't important, but what you realize, your instincts, your bottom line, So you want somebody who's had some experience, who's faced issues and done something about them, seen outcomes. And you want somebody who can communicate and inspire you. I'm describing Ronald Reagan.
You are, I was about to say, but that person is not available this time around.
Well, you look for people that can do these kinds of things.
All right. Can I get you to name candidates?
I really don't want to.
That's fine.
I'm not very happy with what I'm seeing out there.
You're not happy. Last.
Maybe Mike Bloomberg will come in and nobody can get a plurality. It'll go to the House of Representatives. Then we can have a draft Paul Ryan movement.
All right. We'll take that clip and send it to the Speaker's office this very day.
What he has demonstrated, since he's taken over as Speaker, he's obvious, he's able and he knows the issues and all that. But he has taken a rather fractious House of Representatives, and he's managed to get some things to happen.
Already, in just 3 or 4 weeks.
Of governing, and he has an instinct for governing, and that's what you need. You have Senator Cruz, for instance, he has no instinct for governing. We know that. He's demonstrated that.
Donald Trump?
He probably has more of an instinct for how you get something accomplished, but never in government.
Actually, so he's he's built businesses, he's built buildings. You look at the skyline of Manhattan, and there's a Trump building, and there's a Trump building. That's very important to distinguish between what you need to do to get things done in business, and you know, because you were president of Bechtel, a great big company that built things, that was a contractor. Distinguish between that set of skills and what you need to get things done in government. How do they differ?
Well, in government, you're in a political environment. You don't tell anybody to do anything because they're individual actors. You have to persuade, always persuasion. And you have to engage. We always had the view in the Reagan period, if you want me with you on the landing, include me in the takeoff. So we got our INF agreement ratified, I think it was 93-5 or something like that. But there were observers in Geneva. We had constant interactions telling them what was going on. We had the complete negotiating record in a secure room in the Senate, and any senator or certified staff person could come up and look at it, and there was somebody there to answer questions. So they were in on the takeoff, and then it was all described very thoroughly. Congress was not ignored. Right now, the way the executive branch works, it's as though Congress isn't there. They have their view, Congress has its view, and nobody gets along because they're campaigning all the time. Campaigning is an act of division. Governing is an act of putting things together. They're the exact opposites. So if you have to campaign all the time, you're not going to be able to govern. Probably if you pay too much attention to governing, you won't get elected. So there's
constant tension.
There's a little tension there.
Last question. 1941. This is the year. This year you would have been a junior at Princeton. Pretty good football player. In 1941, the publisher Henry Luce, he's the founder of Time magazine, Life magazine, referred to the 20th century as an American century. The 21st century, this century, are we in for a second American century? Or are we going to lose ground to China, various adversaries, Africa?
Well, I think that the American way is the winning way. We have the winning hand. We do have to play the hand. We have to get our policies in shape so that the economy can take off again. We have to get our sort of set of arrangements in shape so that people feel good about themselves. And then we have to be able to reach out and help other countries. And you don't lead in the world by telling people what to do. You lead in the world by being helpful. Let me give an example. People refer often to the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was not a U.S. plan to tell people how to reform their economies. The Marshall Plan said to Germany, France, Britain, and so forth, whose economies were in tough shape, think over carefully what you need to do to get your economy rolling. And then let's discuss it. And if you need some money to help push it along, we've got it. That's the Marshall Plan. But we were not pushing U.S. ideas. We were helping people develop their own ideas for how they think things should go.
How quickly could we see a revival if we have a new administration that does what you just suggested? Things under the Reagan years turned around pretty quickly in the economy. Foreign policy took longer. In other words, what I'm getting at is this notion that the United States may have permanently lost stature, permanently lost standing.
Well, things go up and down, but I think that if we have a strong economy and a self-confident country that reaches out around and is helpful, well, people will be glad we're around. We don't have to be dominating everybody. I don't like the American century. We shouldn't be looking to have this be the American century. We'll thrive. That's fine.
Former Secretary of State George Shultz, thank you. For Uncommon Knowledge and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson. Mm-hmm.